it's Diane. On my mind, the Supreme Court and economic inequality. My guest, journalist and lawyer Adam Cohen, says over the past 50 years, a conservative Supreme Court has consistently ruled in favor of the rich. Cohen says we see this in example after example, from rulings that make it harder for racial minorities and the poor to vote, to decisions that loosen restrictions on how much money corporations and the wealthy can contribute to political candidates. Adam Cohen's new book is titled Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. I spoke with him earlier this week. Adam Cohen, before we begin talking about your book, I'd be interested in your comments on the singling out of Supreme Court Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg by President Trump. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's very troubling. I think it fits into a larger pattern of him attacking the rule of law. But in this specific case, it's really terrible because Sotomayor did nothing wrong. She just wrote a dissent in an opinion that wasn't aimed at him at all. It was just a very proper disagreement with the majority. Ginsburg made some comments a few years ago that are really not important right now. It gives the sense that he's trying to establish some groundwork for attacking the court if it does anything that he doesn't like down the road. So these were troubling words.
What about his argument that both should recuse themselves from any cases having to do with him?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. You know, as I say, Sotomayor did nothing wrong. She pointed out some inconsistencies in the way in which the majority has been treating cases that the federal government brings. That's absolutely her job. She's supposed to do that in a dissent. She did nothing wrong. Ginsburg made a stray comment a long time ago, but it pales in comparison to some of the things that other justices have done. And even now, we're learning reportedly Clarence Thomas's wife is playing a major role in going after Trump critics, if the press accounts are right. You know, what Ginsburg and Sotomayor have done are not things that should lead to recusal at all.
So what kind of impact do you think his words might have?
Well, I think his idea is to undermine the credibility of the court. So there are some cases coming down that could potentially have an impact on him, on having to disclose his finances and things like that. If the court doesn't rule the way he wants, he can then say, look, I told you, the court is filled with my enemies, and I asked them to recuse themselves, and they didn't. So it does seem like he's laying the groundwork for, first of all, rejecting the logic of any opinion that comes down, but maybe even rejecting any orders that come down from the court. So it's definitely not the way we want to hear a president talk about the Supreme Court.
What do you think the role of the Chief Justice should be in this situation?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's disappointing that Chief Justice Roberts has not said anything. It would have been a great occasion for him to step up and say, you know, that Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg have done nothing wrong and that there's no need for them to recuse themselves. You know, the thing is that recusal is left up to the justices themselves. It's not like there's some law or guidebook that you can go to. So there's no rule that Ginsburg and Sotomayor can point to and say, look, we didn't violate the rule, because there aren't rules. So it would be a good moment for the Chief Justice to step up and say, you know, there's really no call for recusal, so they shouldn't.
Do you think the president will continue these comments?
I'm afraid he will, because, you know, as I say, it fits into a larger pattern of his contempt for the rule of law. We've seen him attack a lot of judges. We've seen him tweet about his friend Roger Stone's case and about, you know, them being too tough on him. We've seen him just in general try to undermine a lot of our legal norms. And, you know, the Supreme Court is the big enchilada. So if his goal is to go after our legal norms, attacking the liberals on the court is absolutely something one should predict more of.
And looking now toward your book, you write that wealth inequality in this country is once again where it stood in 1929, just before the Great Depression, and that over the last 50 years, the court itself has played a major role in this trajectory. Talk about how.
Sure. I think we all do know that wealth inequality, income inequality have been rising very rapidly. That's something that gets talked about a lot. It's become a major focus of the current presidential Democratic primary. So the question is, why is that happening? And there are some larger forces that people point to, things like globalization, right? So we've got rising middle classes in countries like India and China that are, to some extent, redistributing some of the wealth nationwide, worldwide. We've got automation is having an effect. Some jobs are being eliminated. People also point to policies from the government that Congress and the president come up with, things like the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts, welfare reform. But in all of these explanations, what I believe is lost is the important role that the Supreme Court has played. The Supreme Court, we just think of as deciding cases between two different litigants, but they absolutely set policies overall for our country. In some ways, they're an architect of the way in which our country will evolve. And I would point to two things, which I do point to in the book. The World Inequality Report 2018, which looked at inequality around the world, said that in the case of the United States, there have been two main drivers of growing inequality, economic inequality, in the last few decades. One is inequality of educational opportunity. The other is a lack of progressive taxation. Well, if we take each of these, the lack of equal educational opportunity, there are some specific cases, particularly one called Rodriguez v. San Antonio School Board in 1973, where the Supreme Court had an opportunity to say the government must provide equal funding to all students, that you can't have more money go to rich school districts than poor districts. By a 5-4 vote, they said, no, the inequality is fine. And then the next year, in a case called Milliken v. Bradley, they said that if schools are very segregated in a city, if Detroit is almost all black, there's no obligation to come up with a desegregation order that goes over the urban-suburban line. And that made it impossible to actually integrate the large school systems. So those were two ways in which the Supreme Court has laid the groundwork for educational inequality. The tax lack of progressivity is directly tied to the Supreme Court's rulings on campaign finance. Going back to the 70s, in a case called Buckley versus Valeo, the Supreme Court said that money is speech and you can't regulate it that much. And they've opened the door in case after case, Citizens United, to all of this, endless flow of special interest money. A lot of that money comes from wealthy people. And one of the things they've bought with that is lower taxes for the wealthy. And we saw that when the Trump tax law was being debated in Congress in 2017, polls showed that the American public wanted higher taxes on the wealthy. But we saw news stories in which wealthy contributors were saying to Republican Congress members, unless you pass big tax cuts for the wealthy, I'm going to stop contributing money. That was what won out. Congress listened to the wealthy campaign contributors, not to the voters. So as I say, the Supreme Court's two lines of cases in education and campaign finance, I think, were major drivers of our current inequality.
At the same time, the court has not been conservative in all areas. I mean, we think about Roe v. Wade. We think about same-sex marriage. But you're talking specifically about economic issues and public education.
That's exactly right. The book is really focused on how the court has driven economic inequality. But I would say also that, we shouldn't get too excited about some of the court's social rulings. And yes, Roe v. Wade absolutely was a major breakthrough. So was same-sex marriage, although they came late to that. They came late to the gay rights movement. People forget now, but in 1986, at a time when the court really could have made a difference in gay rights, they issued a terrible decision, Bowers v. Hardwick, that upheld a conviction of a man for committing sodomy in his home. The police raided his home and arrested him in his own bed. The nation was, I think, ahead of the court on some of these issues. But in any case, yes, there's been some progress on some of the social issues. But what they've done to the poor and the middle class has been terrible.
So tell me about the cases coming up now before the court that could even further create this inequality.
Well, I think we're likely to have a sort of quiet spell through the election. I just get a feeling the court doesn't want to get, too enmeshed in the politics of it. But there are a few things that could be coming down the pike. You know, one is the court only very narrowly upheld Obamacare by a 5-4 vote. That remains in danger, I think. And certainly if the president is reelected and gets one more appointment to the court, and, you know, there are some quite old justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, if he were able to fill one of the liberal seats, I think we would lose Obamacare. You know, another case that's headed up to the court, but again, it's not going to get there immediately, is the Harvard affirmative action case, where a group of Asian American students challenged affirmative action. Harvard, the district court judge, upheld Harvard's affirmative action plan, as the Supreme Court did itself in the 1970s in the Bakke affirmative action case. But if that case were to get to the Supreme Court now, and it's headed that way, even with the current court, it's not clear that there are five justices on the court who will now vote to uphold affirmative action. Roberts has been outspoken about not liking race-based remedies. Well, if the Supreme Court says that affirmative action is unconstitutional, that would have a major impact on our society and definitely have large economic impacts, because affirmative action, although it's not been perfect, has been a major driver of racial minorities' entry into the larger economy, and that could change. So those are, I think, some big things to worry about. But if President Trump were to get one or two more appointments in a second term, I think we're talking about even the potential to go after other parts of the social welfare state beyond Obamacare. So I don't think we're likely to see a big impact before the election, but there definitely are clouds on the horizon.
What about questions regarding President Trump's own finances?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be an issue that I think we're all going to be looking at to see how the court, you know, how much the court insists on him answering to judicial bodies, asking him to turn things over. And, you know, one thing we talked about, the question of whether Justices Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg should recuse themselves, and they should not. But, you know, one thing people lose track of is that President Trump has appointed two of the justices who will be making these decisions. And you do wonder what loyalties, you know, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh have to the man who appointed him. So it'll be interesting to see how tough they're willing to be. Now, by and large, this has been a court that has been very quick to give the Trump administration what it wants. And we saw that just recently with this public charge ruling, where the Trump administration has put in place a wealth test for immigrants, which was challenged in the lower courts, and the challengers won. And the Supreme Court stepped in a very unusual way and blocked the injunctions that were in place nationwide and then a separate one in Illinois. And that was what Justice Sotomayor was objecting to in that dissent that Trump got so agitated about. But what she was objecting to is the fact that the court seemed to be not allowing the regular judicial process to play itself out, where if there's a ruling from a lower court, it gets appealed to an intermediate court and then goes up to the Supreme Court. She was saying that she thinks the conservative bloc is stacking the deck in favor of the administration. So that may also be a warning sign that maybe they're just going to be inclined towards ruling for a president that they like. I think it's something to worry about.
How important is that case in regard to Trump's finances and Deutsche Bank and all the rest?
I think it's very important because, you know, as they say, we don't know what we don't know. So it would be, I think, very important to get more transparency on these things. But it's not clear, you know, as I say, that we're going to, because, you know, one thing we've seen with the court is, you know, we'd like to think that they are neutral legal actors, that they don't take politics into account. But, you know, many of us never really bought that. And I went to law school before Bush versus Gore, and I didn't believe that they were neutral legal actors, even when I was in law school. But when the Supreme Court decided Bush versus Gore, I think for the whole nation, it was a real wake-up moment, because if you remember in 2000, with all that mess in Florida, and it wasn't clear who had won the state and therefore who had won the presidential election, and there were votes that hadn't been counted, I think the nation looked to the court to be objective and to come up with a legal solution to the problem. And instead, we got such a political decision. There was no compromise. There was no attempt to forge a 9-0 consensus opinion. We got the five conservatives all voted to stop the counting of the votes and to put Bush in office. And if you remember, one of the most troubling parts of the Bush versus Gore ruling from the Supreme Court was they actually said in it that this opinion cannot be cited in the future. They were basically saying it's not really law. It's a political decision. So why do I mention that now? Because that was a moment where we saw that when push comes to shove, the court has been quite willing to act in an expressly political way. So it's quite possible that in any of these cases that are really challenging Trump and his presidency and, it's an issue going into the election, but even afterwards, because he's been impeached once. You know, these are cases that could reveal things that might put him in political peril again. We'd like to think that the court is just going to call it as it sees it on the law. But as I say, I think that we now know the court is very likely to make political decisions.
More of my conversation when we come back. Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Adam Cohen. He is a former public interest lawyer. His
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
The book is titled Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. The Chief Justice himself has said several times he wants his court to remain neutral. He wants his court to be seen historically as one that acted fairly and responsibly. So the question comes now that President Trump has challenged the court and the Supreme Court Chief Justice has pushed back against that, how you think that might affect the way the court goes?
Could be a factor, and you're absolutely right. This Chief Justice has said from the beginning, we all remember that at his confirmation hearings, he very famously said that he thought the role of a judge was to be an umpire calling balls and strikes,
right,
not to be a batter. But that, I think a lot of that has been rhetoric and has not really been the reality of the way he and the court have ruled. And, I could give you several examples of that. One of the most shocking decisions that the court has made in recent years is a few years ago, they struck out the heart of the Voting Rights Act.
Yes.
Now, the thing about the Voting Rights Act is it's hard to think of a law that is more central to the American psyche, right? So the civil rights movement, which was, such an important part of 20th century history, one of the jewels of the civil rights movement was the Voting Rights Act. I mean, we had people who were murdered, martyred, fighting for the right to vote, marching for the right to vote. And after those, Southern voting rights protests, we get the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It has been such a revered statute. It was written in such a way that it had to be reauthorized every number of years. And it's been reauthorized again and again by bipartisan majorities in Congress. The reauthorizations have been signed by Ronald Reagan, by George W. Bush. This is about, as close as we have to sort of national scripture, the Voting Rights Act. And the Supreme Court came along a few years ago and struck down the preclearance requirement, which is a critical part of it, which said that if election officials are going to change the rules to make it harder for minorities to vote, they have to get approval first, because we know that very often that has been done in order to move the polling place to the white neighborhoods,
right,
all that. So that was written into the law. It's a very important part of the law. This Supreme Court, struck that down under the leadership of John Roberts, under what I have to say was a completely made-up rationale. Justice Roberts cited something that he called the equal sovereignty of the states. Well, it just isn't really a legal doctrine. And it's not just me saying that. It's not just liberals and civil rights supporters saying that. Judge Richard Posner, who is a very respected, very conservative judge, who was appointed to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago by Ronald Reagan, Judge Posner wrote in Slate magazine after that decision came down, he said, you know, this doctrine of equal sovereignty of the states does not exist. Mm. I've never heard of it because it doesn't exist. Mm. So think about that. Roberts was willing to strike down one of the most revered bipartisan laws that's so critical to our voting based on a made-up doctrine that even Judge Posner says is made up. So to me, that shows a level of activism that is, you know, not consistent with him saying, hey, I'm just an umpire. But also think about it. Voting is critical to power in our country, right? Voting decides whether we're going to have Democratic presidents or Republican presidents, Democratic Congresses or Republican Congresses. This court has been very focused on making it harder for people to vote, harder for minorities to vote, harder for poor people to vote, harder for Democrats to win elections. And look at the way in which he not only took off his umpire's mask, but, you know, picked up a bat, went to home plate and swung for the bleachers on a voting case. And, you know, we shouldn't let him get away with saying, hey, I'm just someone who is, you know, a neutral observer and doesn't think judges should be very involved in things. Because when it's an issue that they care about, they get very, very involved.
Adam, take us back to the Warren Court and what happened when Richard Nixon was elected.
Sure. So the Warren Court was really an amazing moment in American history and in American judicial history. Earl Warren is appointed in 1953. Within a year, the court under his leadership issues Brown versus Board of Education, requiring integration in schools across the South. It's hard to think of a more important and transformative decision than that. So that was kind of the prelude, but there's a lot more to come. Under Warren, the court becomes a real force in the 1950s and particularly the 1960s for democracy and reform and a more inclusive society. And that goes across every aspect of our society. They did things like require that poor people who are accused of crimes are entitled to a government-appointed lawyer if they can't afford one in a case called Gideon v. Wainwright. They required the Miranda warning so that when the police want to question you, they have to first tell you that you have the right to remain silent. So that's criminal justice. But they also were expanding the rights of poor people. They were striking down some really unfair discriminatory rules against welfare recipients. There used to be a rule, the man in the house rule, that if a woman and her children were on welfare, if the woman had a boyfriend who visited occasionally, they would lose all their benefits. The Supreme Court struck that down. So they're fighting for poor people, for racial minorities. They continue to integrate the country, not just schools but other institutions. They are reforming some of our major institutions like prisons and mental hospitals and making them, you know, treat people better, be fairer. It's hard to describe the way in which the Warren Court changed the country. But then Nixon runs for president in 1968 on a promise to end the Warren Court and replace it with a conservative court. He's elected narrowly over Humphrey in a very difficult election, a lot of which turned on the Vietnam War. And he comes into office and he has an amazing opportunity to do that. As it happens, Warren is resigning and Johnson had tried to fill that seat with a liberal successor. He wanted to elevate Abe Fortas, who was on the court and was an old friend of his, to make him Chief Justice. The Senate rejected Fortas, and then Johnson ran out of time. So Johnson leaves office. Nixon comes in with the Chief Justice position about to become vacant as Warren steps down. So Nixon is able to replace Warren with Warren Burger, who's a conservative. So that's one seat and the leadership that he's taken care of. But then Nixon also gets three more appointments in the next 3 years. So he gets four appointments in 3 years, and he's able to appoint four conservative justices who completely change the direction of the court. And one important part of the story, which I think has been lost to history, and in my book I try to really tell it and bring it back, is Abe Fortas, when he's rejected for Chief Justice, remains on the court as just a regular justice, and he's the most liberal member of the court. He's a very important part of the old Warren Court majority. Nixon wants to take his seat. So the thing is, Nixon realizes that Fortas has been weakened by being rejected by the Senate for the position of Chief Justice. He also finds out that Fortas has a relationship with a nonprofit foundation that was set up by a rather unsavory Wall Street investor. So Nixon has his Justice Department investigate Fortas's ties to the foundation.
Yes.
Yeah, and Fortas took a job as a consultant to the foundation while he was on the court. And the foundation worked on civil rights and religious liberty. You know, it's an unusual thing. It looks a little odd today, but other justices and judges have done that. And there was no suggestion that Fortas was doing anything improper.
Yeah.
But Nixon used that to begin investigating Fortas and also had his Justice Department investigate Fortas's wife, who was a lawyer at the firm that Fortas had been at, who had been investigated for some alleged improprieties and withholding documents in a case, but had been cleared of that. But in any case, John Mitchell, who is Nixon's attorney general, who later himself goes to prison for Watergate crimes, Mitchell's a bad guy. He's a real, you know, hardball political player. He goes to the Supreme Court. He talks to Warren before Warren leaves, basically threatens Fortas and Fortas's wife with criminal prosecution. Huh. Fortas is looking at the possibility that he might not only be removed from the court, he and his wife might end up in prison. Fortas gives in. He resigns his seat. Yeah, even though, as I say, there was no basis for it. And, you know, John Mitchell, who had been White House counsel under Nixon, later wrote a book in which he said, look, you know, Mitchell got very lucky because even he knew that he didn't really have anything on Fortas. But that got Nixon one of the four seats that he gets in 3 years. And that proves critically important because I mentioned that Rodriguez case in which the Supreme Court ends up saying we don't need to equalize funding between rich and poor school districts.
Right.
That was a 5-4 decision. And if Fortas had remained on the court, if Nixon had not used his dirty tricks and threatened him and driven him off, Fortas would have been there to cast the fifth vote in favor of the poor school children in Texas, would have equalized funding. Our entire country's educational system might well be different, but for the fact that Nixon drove Fortas off the court, you know, illegally and improperly. So it's a very sad footnote because people look around at the unequal education we have now and there are very rich school districts and very poor districts. No one really is thinking, you know, if Nixon had not driven Fortas off the court, we'd have a very different lineup here.
Interesting. You know, it strikes me that Republicans have been absolutely hell-bent on controlling the judiciary. And I'm not just talking about the Supreme Court. I'm talking about courts all over the country. Why do you think Democrats have not been as active or persevering in doing the same thing?
Well, you know, we always like to quote Mark Twain, who said, I'm not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat, right?
Right.
The Republicans are just very good at this. They're very disciplined and on message. And as you say, they've been very focused on the Supreme Court. Trump actually sent out a tweet a while back that I quote in the book where he tweeted, we must always hold the Supreme Court. So they have a focus on it and they're disciplined and they're just better at it. So, you know, one example of the discipline is folks may remember that Anthony Kennedy stepped down a couple years ago from the Supreme Court. And when he did, he appeared to be in perfectly good health. He wasn't that old. And why did he step down? Well, it looks a lot like he realized that when he stepped down was the last moment he could be sure that Trump would be able to appoint his successor with a Republican Senate. The election was coming up and, you know, the Democrats could have taken the Senate. So that could have put a roadblock. He made sure that he was able to hand his seat off to a fellow conservative, which is what happened. Now, do we see that with the Democrats? Not so much, right? Ginsburg and Breyer, who are well along in years, could have stepped down at the end of the Obama administration and ensured that, you know, young successors were put in place. They didn't do that. that, and that's fairly common. So the rate at which Republicans are able to make sure that they hold on to their seats is just much higher. But as you say, it's a much broader thing. It's also happening at the lower levels of the federal judiciary.
Yes.
And some of that is, you know, someone like Mitch McConnell is just an expert at both slowing down the process so it grinds incredibly slowly when the time comes to confirm Democratic president's appointments, and then speed it up to rocket speed when it's Republican appointments. And they've just been good at that. And they often appoint younger people. I mean, Clarence Thomas was quite young when he was appointed. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was around 60 when she was appointed. You know, Thomas was in his 40s. So they really think of every, you know, trick in the book. And it has worked because, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, if you look at the last 50 years in the elected offices, we have had Democratic presidents and we've had Republican presidents. We've had, you know, Obama and we've had Reagan and we've had George W. Bush and we've had Clinton. Congress has switched back and forth between parties. Both the Senate and the House have gone back and forth, blue, red, blue, red. The Supreme Court has been conservative for 50 years. There's been a conservative Chief Justice. It was Berger, then it was Rehnquist, now it's Roberts. And there have been five conservative votes behind him for 50 years. That's something that the Republicans were able to achieve, you know, through a lot of tactics. And in some case, you know, I say dirty tactics. And I mentioned the theft of the Fortas seat, which was critical to creating this conservative court, right? They took that liberal seat away. But then look at the Merrick Garland nomination, where if Merrick Garland, who Obama nominated to fill Justice Scalia's seat, if Merrick Garland had been confirmed, and he was eminently confirmable. He was on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. He was a very respected judge. He was not even, you know, particularly, you know, left-wing. He had a history of working for the FBI. So if he had been confirmed, as he should have been, that would have been the end of the conservative majority. We would have a liberal majority on the court for the first time.
Which is why Mitch McConnell was not going to let that happen. Talk about the shift, and you call it epical, when Brett Kavanaugh was sworn in.
So Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, confirmation, had, I think, two very important impacts on the court. The first was, you know, that traumatic confirmation hearing. You know, it's just not the way things normally happen, that someone is being nominated to be one of the highest judges in the land, and you get someone like Professor Ford who steps up and says, you know, he sexually assaulted me when we were in high school. And, you know, her testimony was compelling, riveting, and polls showed afterwards that most of the American public believed her, not him. Despite that, because of the aforementioned Mitch McConnell and the majority that the Republicans had in the Senate, Kavanaugh gets confirmed. So we're confirming someone who most of the American public think did something, you know, quite terrible. So that's one traumatic thing. And it's traumatic because, remember, this isn't just, you know, he wasn't being nominated to be our chief scientist or our chief air traffic controller, important jobs as they are. He was being nominated to be a member of the Supreme Court that is the bastion of justice in our society. To sort of someone who, you know, a lot of the American public thinks, you know, committed a heinous crime against a woman, be in that role, very troubling. So that's one part of the nomination. And when you add the fact that Clarence Thomas is still on the court, and, you know, Anita Hill testified his confirmation about some of the things that she said he did, that two of the five members of the conservative majority have been credibly accused of harassing women, very troubling. So that's one part of it. But the other part of it is the conservatives have really wanted not only a conservative majority, but a really pure conservative majority. And it's always troubled them that one of the five conservatives at any time has always been not entirely pure by their point of view. They've been a swing justice. So there was a while that Sandra Day O'Connor was disappointing them because she would, you know, not always vote the party line in abortion cases or in affirmative action cases. And then when she left the court, Anthony Kennedy became that figure of torment for them because he was not a reliable vote, particularly on gay rights issues, but also on some others, including affirmative action. So they've always wanted to get rid of that wavering conservative and replace them with a pure conservative. There was some thought among conservatives that with Anthony Kennedy's retirement, that his replacement could be that critical fifth vote. And we have yet to see exactly how Kavanaugh will shake out, but it may well be, like I mentioned earlier, that, you know, there's some thought that if the Harvard case or another case like that goes up to the Supreme Court, there may not be five votes to hold that affirmative action is constitutional. That would be an epical decision if they'd made it. They weren't able to with Kennedy on the court. Kennedy was actually not a big supporter of affirmative action, did not vote, you know, with liberals very often on anything involving race or civil rights. But in the end, when push came to shove, he was not willing to say that affirmative action was unconstitutional. Kavanaugh could provide the fifth vote to do that. So, and also, you know, Kennedy was the key vote on gay rights. We talked about same-sex marriage. Things like same-sex marriage were voted in by the Supreme Court because the four liberals supported it, but then Kennedy has always been a supporter of the constitutional rights of the LGBT community, and it's been, you know, very surprising to some and horrifying to conservatives. With him gone now, it's not clear that Kavanaugh will be the same. I mean, it's possible. We haven't seen yet. But it could be that they now have the fifth vote even to maybe reverse some of the same-sex marriage rulings. We just don't know. We don't know.
So the question finally becomes, do you think voters are paying attention to the Supreme Court as they think about what's happening in November?
I'm afraid not enough, and I would say not just voters on that list, but I would say the media. It's, you know, on my Twitter feed, and it may tell you the sort of people I follow, but whenever I'm watching a presidential debate and I'm on Twitter, you know, some of the people I follow are saying, why is there not a question about the Supreme Court? Why is there not, you know, and right. It's true. We keep getting the same questions over and over again. So I would like to see the media, the debate moderators, the candidates step up and make this a major issue, because it is a major issue. And, you know, some of the things we've talked about here, I mean, this is a court that could end affirmative action. It could end the constitutional rights of gay people to marry. It could do more damage to middle class and poor people, including it could strike down Obamacare. These are huge, huge issues, and this should be much more central to the campaign. And I'd like to hear everyone talk about it.
Adam, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.